A simple phone call to 911 last July started a conversation about race relations in the United States.
I don't know what's happening. I just had an older woman standing there, and she had noticed two gentlemen trying to get in a house at that number, 17 Ware Street, and they kind of had to barge in.
That's the call that led police to the house of Henry Louis Gates Jr., a prominent Harvard scholar who happened to be trying to get into his own home. But after arguing with the officer, Gates was arrested for disorderly conduct. The arrest was followed by President Obama commenting that the police acted stupidly, and then organizing the so-called famous beer summit. Skip Gates isn't the only Harvard professor to give that day careful thought. Charles Ogletree has a new book called The Presumption of Guilt, The Arrest of Henry Louis Gates Jr., and Race, Class, and Crime in America. He's also the Jesse Clemenko Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. Great being with you.
I wanted to start with something that you say in Chapter 3, which I found really striking. Allow me to read it to you. You said, in some respects, the arrest of one of the country's most prominent scholars in the comfort of his upscale Harvard University home was as egregious in the hearts and minds of some members of the African-American community as the blatant, brutal beating of Rodney King. It suggested there was no place in America where African-Americans could receive what the law guarantees to its white citizens, a presumption of innocence. Do you feel as though those two incidents, the beating of Rodney King in 1991 in Los Angeles and the arrest of Henry Louis Gates in Cambridge, Massachusetts, that they are on an equal par?
No, I don't. But that doesn't change the strongly felt feelings about a lot of people in the African-American community. And as I go on to say, and as you'll see at page 66 about Rodney King, he was under the influence of alcohol, legally drunk, driving excessively above the speed limit, place innocent citizens and police officers at risk of bodily harm or death, refused to respond to efforts to stop. And the remarkable thing about Rodney King that I talk about in the book is that no one realized he was never charged with a crime because of George Holliday's video. The reason that Rodney King is important is because it tells you that below the surface there's a steaming frustration in the relationships between police and the African-American community. And my frustration is that 16 years later, we're addressing the same issues, the relationship between police and African-Americans. And I say in this book, with the central thesis of it, is that this is as much about class as it is about race. And that is, Professor Gates thought he'd earned the right to be treated differently, that he lived in an upscale neighborhood, that he was one who praised the police and they should be there to arrest the criminals. And he was shocked and amazed that he, as he told me in the jail that day, he says, Tree, you've told me about a million men in prison. Now it's a million in me. And it was an eye-opening experience for him to be part of that. And so I hope it's an eye-opening experience about we have a problem that we didn't solve a decade and a half ago, and I hope we'll have a better chance of solving it today.
You point out in your book that Professor Gates was arrested for disorderly conduct, and that's a particular classification which you posit may give a little bit too much leeway to police officers in that what you say that sometimes they're alleged with crimes that's really contempt of cop. That they just get angry with someone's behavior towards them and disorderly conduct allows them to arrest them.
And it's not just me saying it. I mean, Newsweek did a very nice spread on that about the contempt of cop, and a lot of experts have talked about that, that when you raise your voice in front of a police officer, it's one-on-one, it's you and them. But what's different about Gates? First of all, he wasn't drinking. He wasn't on drugs. He didn't have a weapon. Professor Gates is 5'8", 58 years old, about 150 pounds. He's disabled, uses a cane. So he's hardly the threat that you might think that he might be, and he was in his own house.
But the reason
this is such a prominent case is because they look at this prominent black man and this hardworking, diligent white police officer. But what they forget is that two things. Skip Gates showed his Harvard ID in his house. He showed his driver's license with the 17 Ware Street in his house. And the officer could have arrested him and said, I think you're a burglar. Fine. Deal with it later. He could have said, I've heard that there are two burglars here. I'm going to search the house. Fine. He could have done that. Or he could have said, Professor Gates, you've identified yourself. I've got all the information. And I'm going to apologize because we thought it was a burglary. It wasn't. The real hero in this is Ms. Whalen, the one who called 911. And what I put in this book is what we hadn't heard before. She said, I see these two gentlemen. They might live there or work there. She never said, I see two people committing a burglary. They might live there or work there. She never, ever, ever said, that she saw two African-American men with backpacks. That's in Professor Crowley's report. Sergeant Crowley's report. She never said that. And I think that's what I wanted to make sure people look at the record. Don't agree with me or disagree with me. Look at the record and draw your own conclusions. And I think that's what most people should do, and I hope they will do.
You know, it was disturbing to me, the kind of court TV coverage of this, trying to go through the various circumstances. I mean, it seems to me, and I, you know, I'm not a lawyer, professor, but doesn't the Constitution remain in force whether you're polite or not on your own property with ID clearly identifying yourself?
John, it couldn't have been clearer. And people have a First Amendment right to disagree. And you'll see the demonstrations around the country. People don't like the fact that folks will wear signs and make noise, et cetera, but that's what our court has said consistently. You have a right to be obnoxious, to be loud, et cetera. And he was in his house. And the only reason he came outside, as he reported, is that the officer told him to come outside. And he went out there, and then the officer says, he's making noise, I see people, and that's disorderly conduct. That's not what the statute should be used for. And I like Sergeant Crowley. I think he's a good officer. I think he's worked very hard. His coach in high school, the same high school that my kids went to in Cambridge, said that he's a great
African-American
person.
Coach.
Absolutely,
you should point out.
Right. But George Greenwich.
I should point out that were Sergeant Crowley a racist, it would almost make it easier to classify this incident, right? I mean,
exactly.
If he were prejudiced.
Right, and that's why I say, and I think the people start making assumptions because they misinterpreted both what Sergeant Crowley was doing and also what Ms. Whalen was doing. She was a citizen asked to call 911. She did. And I think what we might forget about this whole thing took less than 6 minutes. From the moment the call was made that there's maybe an attempted burglary in progress until he was taken out in handcuffs when he asked them to put them in his front because he couldn't walk with the handcuffs behind him because he couldn't use his cane. 6 minutes. And yet it's become a very long story in our history, and that's why I wrote the book, hoping that people will read it and think about how we can make some differences in getting along. What Rodney King said, why can't we all get along? That was 1992, and why can't we all get along in 2010?
This is definitely a message book, Charles Ogletree, and I'm wondering, you have a different message for the white community than you do for the black community in this book?
It's the same, that we all are responsible. This can't be solved in the black community. We all have to report crime, but we also have to be careful about assumptions we make about race. And it's not always with the police. One example I give here is a friend of mine, Prince Chambliss, an African-American, was cutting his grass in Memphis in his khakis and casual clothes, as he does about every 3 weeks, and an elderly white woman drove by and said, can I get you to cut my grass? How much is it? He says, I don't charge for cutting the grass, but I do get to sleep with the lady of the house. This woman hit the gas and pulled off quickly because, and his point was, not to get angry. I'm not here doing lawn work. I live here. I live in the same neighborhood that you live in, and I've earned the right as a prominent lawyer to do that. But it tells the stories that we make assumptions about people based on a whole series of things, and we need to move beyond that. And I think the real lesson is that all of us as citizens need to figure out how we can prevent crime, how we can be more responsive to police, support their training, and support the efforts to make sure that they can do more community policing, not get there when a crime occurs, but be there before to make sure they can have a relationship with the citizens so that crime will be prevented and that it won't become a problem in any city anywhere in America.
Well, it's a great book. It's The Presumption of Guilt, The Arrest of Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Race, Class, and Crime in America. The author is Charles Ogletree. He's the Jesse Klimenko Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.